just going to give a very brief introduction to Michael Lambert, who I think is already known to many people in the room. As of this year, Michael Lambert has a joint appointment as a professor of anthropology at the University of Toronto, and then also here at the London School of Economics. And even though we only have 50% of him, we're quite happy with this 50% deal, because we certainly feel that Michael Lambeck is a force to be reckoned with in contemporary anthropology. I think a lot of people in the room will be familiar with Michael's research among Malagasy speakers in Mayotte and also in northwestern Madagascar. And you'll know that based on his research in these places over a period of almost 30 years now, Michael's been a very prolific and influential writer. I think a lot of people here will have read his books, Human Spirits, Knowledge and Practice in Mayotte, and The Weight of the Past. And you may also have read some of the many dozens of articles and book chapters and essays, which together constitute a very long CV. But one of the things I would say about Michael's long CV is that he's not the type of person to spin words. And instead, I would say that in Michael's work, we always find two things. The first is a kind of intellectual seriousness. In fact, I would say he has an almost philosophical, perhaps neurotic determination. He uses the word neurotic about himself, so I'm allowed to think. Determination to get beyond the surface of things, to really try to understand what's happening. So I think that even people who actually don't support the kind of anthropology that Michael himself engages in are impressed by the seriousness of his enterprise, and this is an impressive thing. Another point about his work, which I personally find very impressive, is the fact that over these many years, as Michael has become one of the great and good, he's continued very consistently to carry out ethnographic fieldwork. Last year, when we were looking at Michael's CV in the context of his appointment to professorship here at the LSE, one of the really remarkable things we discovered is that over the last 30 years, Michael has done ethnographic research really more or less every year. Sometimes only for a month, sometimes for a period of a few months, sometimes for much longer chunks of time. And I think this is an incredibly impressive achievement for someone who at the same time is turning out huge numbers of very interesting and engaging articles and books, and also being a very good citizen in terms of participating in lots of anthropology committees, supervising lots of students and so on. So it's really quite a remarkable achievement. Anyway, all of this is to say, for those of you who don't know, that when Michael talks about Madagascar and other places, he does actually know something, and you can count on him saying interesting and thought-provoking things in all of his work, including, I'm sure, in his talk tonight, which is entitled Sacrifice and the Problem of Beginning, Meditations on Sakalava Mythopraxis. Michael.
Thank you very much, Charles, for that incredibly warm and nice introduction. And you've been wonderful to work with through all the whole process of negotiating my coming here, and I thank you and also the department as a whole very much for that, for all that. I'd also like to thank you all for coming tonight, and also thank your partners for putting up with you being here on Valentine's Day evening instead of doing something more pleasurable. My voice cuts into the silence, and I begin. No moment is so existentially chilling, so sheer, so unheimlich as the pause before beginning. Having begun, the telling will run its course, practice follow its routines, the author his text. This is not a metaphor of cast dice. Inadvertent circumstance may disrupt the lecture. Practice will reshape itself to meet contingency. The writing itself takes turns the author does not expect at the outset. But no event is so autonomous, so simply itself, as beginning. Of course, a paradox about beginnings is that when we stop in the middle of things to think about them, they are always already in the past. So whether by means of myth or by memory, we are often trying to understand a present open to the future that is itself always already located imaginatively in the past. The problem of beginning, wrote Edward Said, is the beginning of the problem. Nowhere in theory is this problem fully resolved. If beginning was unrecognizable to structuralism, it has fared little better in practice theory's revisions of that doctrine. Beginning is an embarrassment for social theory, and yet it is a regular part of our experience as we gird our loins, face the day, embark on a journey, a book, or a love affair, or as we collectively set our sights, step forward to battle or toward a new world, or imagine our predecessors having done so. Beginning is a problem not only for theory, but for practice itself. This talk addresses the problem of beginning in Sokolova practice and the enactment of beginning in Sokolova historical consciousness, how descendants of the polity of Bwina in northwest Madagascar have imagined the beginning of their monarchy, events which took place around 1700 AD, and how that beginning forms a kind of prototype for other beginnings, how beginning again is always a beginning from the beginning. Following Sokolova lead, this talk is also about sacrifice. That is to say, it is about sacrifice as a kind of beginning, at once a means, an act, and a sign of beginning, and possibly about beginning as a kind of sacrifice. Scene 1, the curation of the knife. The village of Bemilulu sits in a pastoral setting of oxbow lakes along the Betsabuka River, a place of abundant rice fields, waterfowl, and fish, about a half day's travel by bush taxi from the port of Madzanga. Among the houses is a fenced-off enclosure containing a small building. This belongs to Dramandika Vavi, the founding queen of Bwina. Her name means noble lady who surpasses all women. The shrine contains her material artifacts, notably a knife. The shrine is cared for by local inhabitants who claim descent from the queen. They form a clan known as the Tsiarana, which means the peerless, whose duty is to attend to their ancestress as well as to matters of cattle sacrifice and royal ritual. On the occasion of the annual ceremony honoring the queen, many other Tsiarana gather in the village along with members of the royal family who descend from her as well, but through a different offspring. Dramandika Vavi speaks through one of her spirit mediums seated on a raised platform. The knife is deployed whenever there is a burial service at the royal cemetery nearby. Cattle sacrificed at a royal burial must have their throats cut with Dramandika Vavi's knife. Sokolova are concerned with the enactment of Fanumpua, a word that means service to royalty and specifically care of royal ancestors, named personages in the royal genealogy. While care is ongoing, especially taking care not to offend them, specific ceremonies are directed to the curation of the ancestors and their property, their bones and relics, tombs, houses, and artifacts. Some of the ceremonies, like the queen's, are annual events. The largest one, the Great Service, or Fanumpua Bay, held on the outskirts of Mahadzanga, is a New Year's ritual. And yet, as different shrines across the countryside hold their own annual services, each serves in part as a necessary beginning, a prelude, for successive ones at other locations. Thus, the Great Service cannot itself begin until other services have taken place. It is as if the problem of beginning is itself continuously displaced, pushed back into a kind of infinite regress. But such deferral cannot be infinite. If there is to be a conceptualization of beginning, there must be a first beginning, or a first step in the act of beginning. How that is indicated, the problem of beginning, is the problematic of this paper. The queen's knife also figures prominently in the Great Service. It is not literally the same object as the one in Bemilulu, but a different materialization of the same conception that is carried at the head of the annual procession at which the four male ancestors, whose relics reside at Mahadzanga, are paraded around their shrine at the climax of the New Year festival immediately after their annual bath. Each year, the queen's knife is purified along with the relics of her menfolk. Why is the knife of sacrifice such a critical element? And why does it belong to the queen? The queen herself is markedly absent from the main shrine, which is commonly known as the shrine of the four men. These include the queen's husband and their joint son. The queen can never appear on the shrine precincts, and yet the annual service cannot take place without her permission. More than that, the great service begins with the sacrifice of cattle in her name. Now, I don't want to treat either myth or sacrifice as discrete things that can be isolated and inspected in and of themselves. Rather, I look at sacrifice as it appears in Sokolova narrative about the past, in characters instantiated in the present, and as enacted in performances. Our idea of myth, sacred narrative abstracted from its context, is of course itself secular, and therefore cannot give us much sense of what it might be like in a more holistic universe. For Sokolov, a myth is living or lived, quite literally. Ancestral personages are invoked in prayer, accounted for in the observance of taboos, and encountered in embodied performances of spirit mediums. Narrative here has no intrinsic priority. Conversely, sacrifice is not only an act carried out, but an idea or image explored in narrative and other kinds of performance. My talk, my narrative and performance, now well begun, is therefore about neither sacrifice nor myth per se, but rather about a set of Sokolava images and practices from which both sacrifice and myth could be precipitated as analytic constructs, by an earlier generation of anthropologists, perhaps. It's better to say succinctly that my talk is about beginnings. Now, if anthropologists agree that we cannot say why things begin, perhaps we can still say how they begin, or what beginnings are, what it means to begin. This is not to offer to replace one myth with another, as Freud does in Totem and Taboo. The question is less about origins or the problem of discovering what happened than it is understanding beginning as a problem. I distinguish then between beginning and origin. We often think of myth as stories of creation. Myths of origin are about the emergence of something from nothing, of order from chaos, of absence replaced by presence. In contrast, beginnings occur in the midst of life, rarely as a very first beginning, but each time as a new beginning. Beginnings emerge against what has preceded them. Beginnings are therefore located in time and in society, whereas our origins may be situated in a pretemporal or prehistorical horizon. Evans Pritchard, for example, distinguishes New Era traditional accounts which, quote, have a position in structure against those that are the horizon of pure myth, where one mythological event did not precede another, for myths explain customs of general social significance rather than the interrelations of particular segments and are therefore not structurally stratified. That's Evans Pritchard. Beginnings are acts and therefore require specific actors or agents. Origins are events and imply extra human forces. Beginnings entail human intention. Beginnings also imply a narrative that leads forward from their present, whereas an origin is the culmination of its narrative. The acts of Sokolava narrative belong to a human age. Indeed, in Madagascar, there are no first acts of creation, and it is said that people came to the island rather than originating there, in agreement with anthropologists on this. Key acts are ones of planting, burying, and setting down roots, rather than of coming up autochthonously through the soil. Edward Said, to whom I'm much indebted, argues that, quote, beginning and beginning again are historical, whereas origins are divine. He says further, quote, the designation of a beginning generally involves also the designation of a consequent intention. When we point to the beginning of a novel, for example, we mean that from that beginning, in principle, follows this novel. The beginning, then, is the first step in the intentional production of meaning. End of quote. Thus, beginnings are active. Beginnings are humanly made, not naturally or divinely given. Along the path through the forest, they are the first step into a clearing, the first stroke of the axe to mark the trail. Scene 2. From the Schwarzwald to Burg La Reine and thence to Ithaca, the rights, wrongs, and rings of passage. The ring of the axe is no idle metaphor. Chopping, cutting, spilling, killing, in a word, sacrifice, is one of the ways that we mark time, one of the clearest acts of beginning. In beginnings, the flux of homogeneous time is overcome. The stream is parted into a before, a now, and a henceforward, into a past, present, and future. Beginnings signal the self-conscious insertion or intervention of the human act and the recognition of time's place in human experience. Simultaneously, they make spatial discriminations as beginning is materialized in the chopping of a tree or the spilling of blood, and localized, marking a place in the extension of space, a point or a path and a direction. In the rites of passage, cutting is described as a symbolic act of separation. Arnold van Gennep, as you know, understands ritual as both temporally constituted and temporally constitutive, enacted and enacting, moving its subjects along trajectories of successive social statuses. He pictured the life cycle as a successive habitation of a series of rooms. The passage between them is enacted through ritual, as though one paused at each threshold to rearrange one's habit and demeanor and took a deep breath before stepping through. Victor Turner developed the model in a series of brilliant analyses, But with hindsight, it may be fair to say that this elaboration became a kind of appropriation. Where Van Gennep distinguishes three phases of ritually produced movement, separation, transition, and incorporation, Turner famously focuses on the middle, liminal phase. In elaborating liminality, Turner addresses the nature of transition and is certainly true to an aspect of ritual and temporality. But as a result, we have come to think of the liminal phase as primary and the other phases as mere brackets or containers of the precious liminal cargo. The act of separation, the bracing of the shoulders, and the decisive first step are displaced or overweighted by the passion characteristic of liminal beings and their rebirth. Thus, the question of beginning has been overshadowed by the power of Van Gennep and Turner's model of transition. Yet beginnings are often the whole point of rituals, the reasons for which they are conducted in the first place. Consider the term popularly used to describe rites of passage, namely initiation. Whereas initiation is the prototypic rite of passage has come to connote some kind of drawn-out process, the word to initiate more fundamentally means simply to begin or to set going. Think also of the meanings of initial and initiative. In the sense of beginning, the verb to initiate does not have the strong transitive sense of initiating someone, but only a weaker transitive sense of initiating a course of action. The verb to begin can also be used in the intransitive sense of simply beginning. Here, the end or object is intrinsic to the means, and thus the action is understood as valuable in itself rather than instrumental. The very category of rite de passage might sometimes be better characterized by a shift of emphasis as rites of beginning. As codification and realization of intention and commitment, the beginning subsumes what follows. Enactment of the remaining phases of the ritual are but fulfillment of what is established in setting forth. In sum, the model of ritual as transition is ready for another look. Viewed as wholes, rites de passage are themselves actually beginnings. Initiation means literally beginning and then admission. Transformation and induction are secondary meanings, reinforced by the tripartite Van Gennep-Turner model. Turner's elaboration of the middle phase obviates understandings of sheer beginning or final end. Now, liminality is a spatial metaphor, and it's one of waiting and passivity. I would supplement it with the temporal phenomenology of action. Rituals are frequently culminations of what is past and anticipations of what will follow. Often they are both simultaneously. Sacrifice is both a passionate culmination for the victim and a significant initiative by the person who offers it. It draws a line in blood between before and after. Once you have killed something, there is literally no going back for either the victim or the killer. Sacrifice is thus a materialization of intention and a consummation of resolution. How much more powerful all this is when the victim and the sacrificer are one and the same person. Scene 3, the Shrine of the Four Men. The Great Service sets the Sakalava community on a fresh start every year. But critical to the success of the ceremony of new beginning is its own beginning. In Sakalava fashion, the key acts happen backstage. Each year, ancestral approval for the service must be sought and confirmed. Rising in the bodies of spirit mediums, royal ancestors open the gate or clear the path to move ahead. Thus, intentionality is marked from the outset. Both the intention of the living producers of the ritual, who state their aims very clearly in addressing the ancestors, and the intention of the ancestors, who explicitly acquiesce and join in the wish to see the ceremony successfully completed. A week before the public beginning of the New Year's festival, and consequent to her acquiescence, descendants of the queen gather at the shrine to make a bovine sacrifice on her behalf. They signify their commitment by offering the beast, and the animal itself, like all Sakalava sacrificial beasts, must indicate acquiescence of its own by not bellowing or struggling when it's thrown. When the animal is then killed, the skin is then stretched to dry and used to refurbish the shrine's two sacred drums. The vitality inherent in the life of the beast and the intentionality of the offering are transposed into the vibrancy of the drums. There is a literature associating percussion with transition, but I emphasize here its significance as beginning and enactment. Drumming is both energetic and unambiguous. The drummer beats the drum. Each movement of the arm is specific and deliberate. The energy of the arm is transferred to and enlarged by the vibrations of the drum skin. The rhythm of the drum continues to emit the intention of the sacrifice. The passivity of the beast, silently submitting to the knife, is transcended by dynamism, noise, and vitality. The drums are a medium for the active force of the victim. In contemporary Sakalava sacrifice, then, value moves from the labor of raising the animal through its market price, but also, I argue, from the intention of the donor through the acquiescence of the beast and from the throb of life through the spilled red blood to the pulsing of the drums made from the victim's skin. Then, from the drums that excite and incite to the acts of those who respond to its rhythm, in anticipation, in attention, in dance, and in labor and loyalty, in virtuous acts of commitment to the monarchy, obeisance to the ancestors, and acknowledgement of hierarchy, hence in granting power to Dramandika Vavi herself. And so I'm happy to say this is a version of the process of the dissolution of death into authority described and analyzed by Maurice Bloch for the neighboring Mirna that combines mystification with morality. The initial sacrifice is described as an offering on behalf of the queen, but it is also a repetition of her original sacrifice. Those who perform the offering stand in for their ancestor who made the first sacrifice. Just as Dramandika Vavi's original act began the polity, so does it begin the new year, which is also a celebration and reenactment of the polity and includes offerings to the original monarchs by their subjects. Because many of the offerings end up in the hands of the living monarch, and because acts of work, offering, and obeisance form the substance of the polity, the celebration is a literal as well as a symbolic enactment. But my point here is simply that both the historical polity and the annual enactment begin with the queen's sacrifice. However, the queen's original offering was not composed of cattle. This is a point to which we shall return. Saklava emphasize and elaborate the beginning of their service with various deliberate steps before the public display, putting the weight, one could say, more on the intention than the accomplishment, and which, in fact, was a kind of anticlimax to me. The sacrifice of the queen's beast forms a preface to the ensuing festival. It is relatively private, concerning only her own direct descendants, mediums, and shrine workers, whereas the festival is public, incorporating thousands of people through numerous forms of attachment. The sacrifice is also quite discreet. Most people do not know the connection between the queen and the drums, but it is absolutely critical. The festival cannot take place without the queen's acquiescence, as provided in her speech through a medium, and performatively accomplished in the sacrifice. Moreover, the drums are one of the most important heirlooms and signs of royal legitimacy. They must be renewed each year, their skin must be that of the queen's cattle, and their rhythm must punctuate the ensuing events. Not only the rehearsal of a genealogical charter, these acts are conditions that enable the felicitous performance of the subsequent main ritual events. But they are also performative events in their own right. The great service is front-loaded with a series of such events that establish the intention and willingness to proceed. It is as though Sakalava are preoccupied with the sort of infinite regress of intentionality, the ghost in the machine described by Gilbert Ryle. Albeit in the Sakalava case, this is located in the external, interpersonal world of the polity rather than the internal, private one of the mind. Ryle, of course, saw regress as the product of a category mistake, but it may well be that this category mistake is not so easy for humans to avoid, that mind and body and the mind-body problem are part of the human condition, and that the Durkheimian problem of social solidarity and moral commitment is formally similar, and the problem of beginning is one of its manifestations. The series of ritual acts, productive and demonstrative of intention and commitment, and each a necessary condition for the succeeding one, are Sakalava expressions of the problem. Scene 4, Morningside Heights. Some years before he became famous as the author of Orientalism, Edward Said wrote Beginnings, subtitled Intention and Method, from which I have already quoted. Here, Said is interested in creative production. Every work of art has its beginning, its conception, and the way that conception is activated or materialized in a first sentence, note, or brushstroke. When I was writing the first draft of this paper, the film adaptation had just come out, and that film really beautifully conveys the agony of beginning a work of art. Said, of course, ignores the field of ritual, but his account is extremely relevant for social practice. What sort of action, he asks, quote, transpires at the beginning? How can we, while necessarily submitting to the incessant flux of experience, insert, as we do, our reflections on beginnings into that flux? Is the beginning simply an artifice, a disguise that defies the perpetual trap of forced continuity? Or does it admit of a meaning and a possibility that are genuinely capable of realization? Close quote. Said answers that beginnings are necessary. Quote, without at least a sense of a beginning, nothing can really be done, much less ended. A beginning gives us the chance to do work that compensates us for the tumbling disorder of brute reality that will not settle down. Among Said's contributions is a distinction between transitive and intransitive beginning. And I got another long quote from him. Two kinds of beginnings, this is his quote, his voice. Two kinds of beginnings emerge, really two sides of the same coin. One which I, Saeed, call temporal and transitive, foresees a continuity that flows from it. This kind of beginning is suited for work, for polemic, for discovery. However, in attempting to push oneself further and further back to what is only a beginning, a point that is stripped of every use but its categorization in the mind as beginning, one is caught in a tautological circuit of beginnings about to begin. This is the other kind of beginning, the one I, Saeed, call intransitive and conceptual. It is very much a creature of the mind, very much a bristling paradox, yet also very much a figure of thought that draws special attention to itself. In sum, and I'm continuing in his words here, the point of departure has two aspects that animate one another. One leads to the project being realized. This is the transitive aspect of the beginning, that is, beginning with or for an anticipated end, or at least expected continuity. The other aspect retains for the beginning its identity as radical starting point, the intransitive and conceptual aspect, that which has no object but its own constant clarification. These two sides of the starting point entail two styles of thought and of imagination, one projective and descriptive, the other tautological and endlessly self-mimetic. The transitive mode is always hungering for an object it can never fully catch up with in either space or time. The intransitive can never have enough of itself. Scene 5, the countryside west of Mahajanga, circa 1700. The Sakalava have reached the country of Buina, where they would like to settle and rule. An oracle advises the king, "In order to succeed, you must sacrifice what is dearest to you." The king offers the best cattle from his herds, but they are not acceptable. He offers gold, and then fine Chinese porcelain, but they too are insufficient. Finally, his wife announces, "I am what is dearest to you," and so she sacrifices herself. I guess this is appropriate for Valentine's Day. This is an extreme distillation of the founding of the Sakalava polity, but it's sufficient for my purpose here. We can see now that if Dhrammadikavavi is absent from the main shrine, it is precisely because its very existence is predicated upon her death. Moreover, it is not merely the sacrificers who take the queen's place in the annual ceremony, but the cattle themselves. They are killed not only on the queen's behalf or in her honor, but with her knife and in her stead. The throat that this knife first cut was the queen's. Each sacrifice is a repetition and recognition of her original act. Each victim is identified with her. It is her skin and her life that animate and empower the drums. It is her intentionality that produces and permeates the ensuing ceremony and that infuses the resolution of the celebrants as loyal subjects. As a character in the Sakalava poesis of history, Dhrammadikavavi signifies determination. It is her determination that is harnessed to ensure and energize the enactment of the great service. It is her determination that is diffused to her descendants and to her subjects, the general population who have produced and renewed the polity through their own acts of sacrifice, service, and celebration over the course of 300 years. Her resolve is evoked in her every appearance and lends itself to every act carried out with her knife and in her name. Determination is an interesting word, seemingly pulled between free agency and inevitable coercion. Dhrammadikavavi's sacrifice is deeply intentional, yet to call it choice would trivialize it, as though Abraham or Isaac had a choice. To draw upon Saeed again, it is, quote, a necessary certainty, a genetic optimism that continuity is possible as intended by the act of beginning. Consciousness of a starting point from the vantage point of the continuity that succeeds it is seen to be consciousness of a direction in which it is humanly possible to move, as well as a trust in continuity. In fact, Dhrammadikavavi extracted a promise from her husband as a condition of her sacrifice, namely that only their joint descendants would rule. His continuity would be equally hers. In its transitive aspect, then, the beginnings thus conform to Malinowski's notion of a charter, in that the myth establishes legitimacy to rule and both specifies and restricts succession to office. Yet it differs from many genealogical charter myths in validating bilateral ancestors. The queen effectively cuts off all the king's collaterals and other descendants. The king and queen's respective children by other partners form two separate clans, closely associated with royalty, but distinct from it. Descendants from the queen's alone are the tsiarana, the peerless, who maintain and wield the sacrificial knife. And the king's side have rule over the graveyards. In comparison with the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, and especially the story of Abraham and Isaac, the following points are salient. A, the victim is a woman. B, the victim is said to kill herself. C, the victim is not an offspring, but a spouse and a parent. D, the sacrifice is fully carried out. There is a human death. And E, there is no direct recipient, no divine being to whom or on whose behalf the sacrifice is given. There is much to say about gender and about mothers and sons, but having begun an essay on beginnings, I must stay on track. Germane to the present analysis is the determined yet voluntary quality of the sacrifice, the completion and finality of the act, and the absence of a divine arbiter or recipient. Thus, whereas biblical sacrifice seals God's promise to look after his people, Sokolov's sacrifice seals the people's promise to care for Dramandika Vavi, her son, and his descendants. So the next part of the paper is called Sacrifice as Exemplary Beginning. There are many theories of sacrifice. I do not intend to review them, nor to adjudicate among them. Nor do I propose to add another theory. I merely provide a redescription. I want to show that sacrifice is an exemplary mode of beginning, and hence the beginning affords one way to interpret sacrifice. This is certainly not the most intuitive interpretation, since for the person, animal, or object destroyed, sacrifice would appear to form most saliently an ending. In a sense, each new beginning signals simultaneously the end of what it departs from, and perhaps the deaths of alternatives not taken. But I suggest more strongly that endings form and substantiate beginnings. I do not suggest that this is the only way to understand sacrifice, but I do admit that one way to read my argument is that no theory of sacrifice, that is, no explanation that draws upon forces external to the act itself, is necessary. And this is akin, perhaps, to what Levi-Strauss argues with respect to totemism, or what Steiner and Douglas argue with respect to taboo. So I begin here with sacrifice as a literal act. By literal, I mean here univocal, exact, and unambiguous, hence where certainty can be distinguished from uncertainty. The body is often the ground for the literal. The body is literally grounded in burial, and authors such as Astuti, Bloch, and Middleton have noted how in Madagascar, this finally establishes exclusive social identity. Sacrifice is one of the most literal acts possible, both as an action and in terms of its end product, i.e. a dead body. To be sure, the sacrifice of a cucumber for an ox or an ox for a human can be understood metaphorically. But these are merely replacements of one object of sacrifice for another, not metaphors for other, more consequential kinds of acts. At bottom, they are still sacrifice. And for the ox, his life is no metaphor. Cut flowers die. Liquid cannot be put back into its container. Like Humpty Dumpty, a sliced cucumber cannot be put back together again. There may be some ambiguity as to whether a given act of killing is sacrificial or what that might mean, but killing in and of itself is always a literal act. For the victim, there is no return, nor can the killer withdraw her act. Cutting throats and spilling blood are literal acts. The object can be metaphorically displaced from royal self to human subject, from animal to vegetable, but the act of sacrifice is no metaphor. The gift and its limits. It's often argued, following Mohs, that there can be no pure gift, since the obligation to give is always met with the obligations to receive and to return a gift. The recipient who does not offer a return is beholden to the donor, and the donor achieves a higher moral status in that respect. Hence, no gift can be said to be characterized by pure disinterest. What of sacrifice? In Dramandika Vavi's case, while her sacrifice was noble and courageous, no Sokolova would suggest it was undertaken without self-interest. Dramandika Vavi struck a bargain. She asked for something in return. However, what her sacrifice shares with the idea of the pure gift is the impossibility of a full return. Here lies the source of her power. Why can there be no equivalent return? To answer that, I must address the question of who her recipients are and how I know that her gift was not disinterested. First of all, there's no third party, no deity to receive or be honored by Dramandika Vavi's sacrifice. The instigator is a diviner, and he's responding to the workings of a neutral, amoral destiny. The immediate beneficiary is posited as the king, her husband, but her death is simultaneously his loss. Indeed, it is phrased in those very words as that with which he could not bear to part. Yet, Dramandika Vavi's quick response actually turns things in a much more interesting way. In sacrificing herself, she seizes his role as the offerer of sacrifice and achieves the perjurance of her own name and rule. What the king loses is not just his wife, but his agency, what is dearest to him indeed. By establishing his exclusive right to succession, the queen makes their son the direct beneficiary. It is only towards him that her sacrifice might be said to be disinterested, and yet it is precisely because of her identification with her son that it is most self-interested. It is his, and therefore her descendants, who succeed him. His paternal half-siblings, the other children of her husband, are specifically excluded and disinherited. More generally, the beneficiaries are all subsequent members of the kingdom of Buina. This has a sharp ideological angle, of course. The queen's subjects are expected to honor her for effecting the conditions under which her descendants rule over them, as well as identifying with her as the ideal subject. When Brahma Dinkavavi rises in the bodies of her mediums, it is evident that she went willingly but not selflessly. She retains great attachment to the things of this world, to her son in particular. And she is especially rude to her husband. When they both appear together, he shows his wife great affection and puts his arm around her, but she soon gets impatient. After a few minutes, she says brusquely, "What are you still doing around here? No one needs you any longer." And so the conqueror and first king of Buina slips meekly away from his shrill wife and out of the body of his medium. He is, in her eyes, irrelevant. He is eternally beholden. He cannot return her gift. If the queen gave up her life on behalf of her husband, it is clear that he in turn has given over his authority to her. In response to supplicants, the king speaks in platitudes and is generally amenable to whatever is proposed. The queen, however, is forthright, assertive, and tough, expecting people to uphold the standards of the polity for which she gave her life. She inspires respect and fear, not only in her husband, but in her human subjects. She is known to be harsh, and her devotees are afraid of her wrath. Dramadikavavi's sacrifice is a gift that must be received, yet cannot be returned in full, and hence cancelled. The debt to her is, in a sense, what keeps the polity running. Generation after generation must bow to her authority and respond to the interpolation of her drums. Each royal succession must ensure that the promise to her remains fulfilled. Acknowledgement is mandated, but no return could ever be sufficient to cancel the debt. Her gift cannot be canceled, not only because she courageously gave her life and no larger gift could be imagined, nor because the existence and persistence of the political community is the outcome of her act, not only for the obvious reason that she is no longer fully present to benefit from a return gift, but also because what she offered was manifestly a first gift. Any and all returns, even were they to be equivalent, are quite literally secondary. Only one act in a sequence can be first. Dramadikavavi thereby points to a problematic of the gift literature left unaddressed by Mohs, and so far as I know, by his successors. You could easily prove me wrong on this. These are the questions. What constitutes a first gift? Which donor stands out as the original source of the how to which the gift must return? Moreover, if every gift engenders a return, how do we know that any gift is not always already a return? How is a gift marked as first? Where and how does the chain of reciprocity begin? How can one break it and start anew? My point is that sacrifice is one way to mark a gift as first. Indeed, this may be implicit in our understanding of the distinction between sacrifice and gift. Blood sacrifice or self-sacrifice makes an especially good beginning, a first gift, because it is a gift that does not, indeed cannot, return to its origins. It is the gift that cannot be returned, nor canceled, nor withdrawn. The only thing to do with it is to honor it. Now I want to talk about execution. Heidegger has written, "To the anticipation which goes with resoluteness, there belongs a present in accordance with which a resolution discloses the situation." The question is, how is resolve disclosed or realized, made real, both for actors and for their public? The irreversibility of blood sacrifice is certainly one way. A blood sacrifice is an execution. According to the dictionary, to execute means, one, to carry a plan, command, law, or judicial sentence into effect, to perform an action or operation, to make a legal instrument valid by signing, sealing, etc., to discharge an office or function. Two, to carry out the design for a product of art or skill, to perform a musical composition. Three, to inflict capital punishment on. To execute a living being in sacrifice is simultaneously to execute a plan or course of action. In both Malagasy, where the relevant verb is manapaka, and English, we see how central killing is to the idea of carrying out a definitive and irreversible social act. Outright killing, of course, is not the only form of executive bloodletting. We can compare this to scarification, for example, or to defloration. In Mayotte, where I worked before in northwest Madagascar, a woman can give up her virginity only once. Done in the wrong context, it is simply an ending and thus destructive. Done in the right context, it is a beginning, the first moment of adult sexuality and the consummation, as we say, of marriage. The act of submitting to defloration is sacrifice in this sense, a formal, decisive, and irreversible execution, and a gift that can never be fully returned. It is no coincidence also that it's likened to the act of male circumcision. And de Hoesch, in his work on sacrifice in Africa, where he talks about it as introducing differentiation, makes nice comparisons between circumcision and menstruation and so on. Action and passion. Rituals are decisive deeds, yet they are acts in which people submit to something larger than themselves. In this respect, as Heidegger put it, quote, man is not the opener of truth, but the opening for it. Rituals thereby combine action and passion in a heightened manner. These two dimensions correspond respectively to Said's transitive and intransitive modes of beginning. Whenever I mention Heidegger, I'm skating on very thin ice, and you may already have concluded that I've fallen in. But I can't resist an allusion to Heidegger's concept of Gelassenheit, releasement or letting go, which is not simple inaction or passivity. As Dahlmeier notes, quote, an engagement in being challenges or decenters the customary focus of action theory on desire, will, or deliberate intentionality. Instead, the accent is shifted to ontological participation in which the actor is released, at least partially, from the dictates of an instrumental pursuit of objectives. This shift does not remove moral political responsibility. Sacrifice, especially self-sacrifice, exhibits this inextricable connection of action and passion, or resoluteness of released engagement. It is not dying in a simple passive sense, nor killing in a simple active sense. Not accepting the inevitability of death, but as Leinhardt emphasized, converting it into life. Sacrifice is a negation of the act of giving birth, and yet strangely like it. It is giving death, submitting to it, bearing it forth. Like birth, an act at once transitive and intransitive. And it can provide a sharper sense of beginning even than birth. A birth can be undone through death, but a death cannot be undone. As Rappaport argues, in lending themselves to a ritual, performers inevitably accept its terms and effects. There is no more complete mode of participation in this sense than allowing oneself to be sacrificed. Self-sacrifice is the limit act of committing oneself to the liturgical order, and hence of confirming, establishing, and realizing it through one's very being. This is equally a form of identification with it. Others then realize their own commitment through their attachment to or identification with the sacrificial victim or sacrificer. Instances of exemplary acceptance of this kind include, of course, Jesus on the cross, Dinka spearmasters buried alive, and dying pilgrims in Benares who prepare their bodies as offerings to the gods on the model of Vishnu's act of creation. As the sacrificer is identified with the sacrifice, so is the ending coextensive with the beginning and the transitive with the intransitive. The sacrificer conjoins in her act the indexical and canonical aspects of ritual and does so more completely than can be imagined through any other means. We see in this fusion a deeper significance for sacrifice than that presupposed by communication or communion with the deity. In submitting to the liturgical order, it becomes a part of her being, and she too becomes an intrinsic part of that order. Actors in action can then only be described, interpreted, and evaluated with respect to prior commitments, with respect to what has been already begun. Dhammadikavavi simultaneously acts and submits. Such action by means of submission, or subjection through action, is the hegemonic form of belonging in the tributary Sakalava polity. In this sense, Dhammadikavavi is an exemplary subject, and like all Sakalava rulers, expected to be simultaneously more powerful than the average citizen, but also more bound by taboo and obligation to the ancestral order, more intimately part of it. Equally, we can see in sacrifice an epitomization of the Durkheimian understanding of society, in which each member must give up some individuality in order to be transformed at a higher level into a moral person. Social being, more generally, entails a dialectic of action and passion, of taking in, doing, and becoming what is expected of us, or perhaps what is unexpected, and in taking a purchase on what we are becoming and have become and making it ours. The idea of beginning captures this double edge of social subject and agent. In beginning a new project, even as one is the agent of its production or enactment, one throws oneself into it. One subsumes oneself in the practice that it entails, and one is thereby partially consumed by it. And so, if beginning is signified or realized in sacrifice, that is in part perhaps because beginning is, in a way, itself an act of sacrifice. A few words about time and intention. Both Van Gennep and Turner understand rites of passage as transitions. I have been more interested in sheer beginnings, in beginning as an existential problem, and also in how people conceptualize, announce, and enact beginning, how they in fact begin. In Said's terms, this is to shift the emphasis from transitive to intransitive acts. Understood in its intransitive aspect, beginning in the form of sacrifice is neither a gift, nor an instrumental act, nor a referential statement. It is simply itself. Here we approach Wittgenstein's critique of Frazer. It does not make sense to see ritual as an expression of something other than itself. It simply is what it is, a necessary part of the life of a ceremonial animal. Writing as a professor of literature, Said is naturally most interested in beginning as poesis, the bringing into being of a new cultural artifact, a work of literature or art. I have emphasized less poesis than practice, seeing beginning as the intentional engagement in social endeavors, commitments, or games. This is partly a matter of anticipation of outcome, partly of submission to the rules, craft, or ethics that the practice entails. Aristotle distinguishes poesis and practice, making and doing, but in beginning, in authoring a book, performing a ritual, or founding a polity, the distinction may be negligible. Following the Sokolova cue, I've argued that the intentionality or resolution entailed in beginning is well signified in the act of sacrifice. Problems of uncertainty and alternative come into focus most clearly at beginnings. Sacrifice can, and with a stroke, end them. Sacrifice combines the ethical consequentiality of judgment with the decisiveness of choice. It thereby forms not merely a kind of natural symbol of beginnings, but a natural means to execute them. I argue both that the story of Dramandigavavi addresses the problem of regress in Sokolova historicity, providing, retroactively, a founding moment and a coalescence of intention, and that the continuation of sacrifice, henceforward figured in her name by means of her knife, continues to make this available in the ongoing life of the polity. Rites de passage belong to long cycles of generational repetition, and that is an important part of the experience for participants. But Dramandigavavi's act is portrayed retroactively as original, a first act of beginning, an initiation in the literal sense of the term, a particular and deliberate intervention in history. Subsequent enactments are not only beginnings in themselves, but draw their potency from this paradigmatic act of intervention, firstness, and resolve. It comes time to displace this somewhat recursive discussion of beginning with a definitive ending. I've been speaking, actually, about ethics, I think. Beginnings cast intention and commitment forward. In drawing from the past, they render valuable what follows from them, and as performative acts, they set the terms of reference against which subsequent events and practices are to be judged. Indeed, without beginnings, it's hard to see how our actions could be conceived in ethical terms. Who we are as moral persons is in large part a consequence of the beginnings we have enacted or participated in. Some of these happen before we reach adult consciousness, as we are named, baptized, circumcised, and so forth. Later in life, we take up charges with fuller consciousness and resolve, and we indicate this to ourselves and to others, just as we realize it for ourselves, sometimes retroactively, in beginning. It is through such explicit engagements and undertakings that our specific ethical lives and characters are formed. They provide the basis for both the cultivated dispositions and the ends and means that constitute us as ethical persons. As a powerful and definitive mode of beginning, sacrifice exemplifies these ethical functions. Once committed and remembered, sacrifice can be intrinsic to who one is as a person or a society. Who one is thereby understood existentially rather than essentially through the sheer initiation of beginning. Through the sheer initiation of being. And yet, despite the emphasis on intention and resolution, this is hardly the continuous freedom that Sartre advocates. That is because each act of sacrifice is simultaneously a passion. Each turns us irrevocably in a certain direction, locates us on a certain path, and each invites identification and repetition. Each undertaking we initiate must be made with respect to commitments always already engaged, subject positions always already imposed, each new beginning with respect to beginnings already begun. I'm describing regulation or channeling in the flow of social and existential value, the mastering of creative and ethical potential, that is, setting its direction and establishing and accepting its consequences. Of course, this does not happen equally effectively everywhere and not without considerable debate. We might contrast an ostensibly relatively orderly tradition, like that of Sakalava at the time I visited them, with more chaotic scenes in which society appears to have lost its way. These may be characterized by epidemics of witchcraft, which by inverting or perverting the logic of sacrifice, both demonstrate and affect the collapse of ethical order. The rhythm of regular beginning there is displaced by rupture and increasingly frantic attempts at establishing new beginnings. I've been using beginnings as a means also to read across the tradition-modernity divide, but I should add that Said himself worked with a distinction between tradition and modernity that has quite different implications. Indeed, Said sees beginning or saw beginnings as distinctive of modernity. He argues that contemporary writers and critics can no longer easily imagine themselves within a tradition, quote, a place in a continuity that formerly stretched forward and backward in time. After Nietzsche, a text has become, he says, an invitation to unforeseen estrangements from the habitual. In a masculine idiom quite foreign to Sakalava, Said distinguishes father-son succession, which he calls dynastic, bound to sources and origins, mimetic, from what he calls brotherly displacements, complementarity and adjacency. Instead of a source, we have the intentional beginning here. He contrasts these also in a Viconian language as the sacred and the Gentile, respectively. This distinction doubtless owes its formulation to the structuralist contrast between the syntagmatic and the paradigmatic, no less than to Vico. I find it overdrawn, and indeed something of a rehearsal of modernity's own ideology, an ideology, dare I say it, of traditionalism comparable to that of Orientalism. I have demonstrated the relevance of Said's superb analysis of beginnings precisely for the succession characteristic of tradition, which is not nearly so uninformed by intention, reflection, uncertainty, contestation, or women's agency as Said's analysis would appear to imply. Tradition is neither timeless nor mindless. That is to say, it is not without beginnings. Beginnings are not routine. At least, in Sakalava's service, every effort is made not to take them for granted. Each beginning actively solicits intention and explicitly demands it. Such intentionality, as Rapoport underscores, is transformed through ritual action into commitment. A difference from the situation of the modern writer described by Said is that commitment is not simply to the work at hand, hence fragmentary and fragmenting, but to a wider order within which specific works and beginnings are construed and authorized. If beginnings do not serve to distinguish between tradition and modernity, perhaps the Gentiles, though, can no longer encode them as sacrifice. Marshall Berman finds modernity's myth of beginning in Goethe's Faust. Faust's pact with Mephisto is a precise inversion of sacrifice. You reap the material benefits and postpone the ethical reckoning. It is life lived on credit, on capital. Yet even Faust must sign his contract with a drop of blood. Blood's a very special ink, you know, says Mephisto. If endings are beginnings, so too, I have indicated, are beginnings, including inaugural lectures, endings of a sort. And so I end with a final word from Said, quote, beginning is a consciously intentional activity whose circumstances include a sense of loss. Thank you.
Guess that there aren't a lot of people sitting in the room who immediately have a question on the tip of their tongue for this particular lecture. It reminds me a bit of David Lamb once saying that after a supervision with Morris Block, he had to go lie down in a dark room for an hour and think about it, and then he had to.
Dear, I hope it wasn't that bad.
But what I'd like to suggest instead is that we retreat to the fifth floor of the old building in the senior common room, where we have a reception to which everybody's invited. And then you can grab Michael personally buy his jacket, and you can ask him the question that you want to ask him up there. I think it'd be better to do that over a glass of wine instead of here. So could I thank Michael again, and then invite everyone, fifth floor of the old building, for a reception.